slow motion, the old man began to weave and wobble erratically, swaying wildly from side to side, his bulging carrier bags creating a sort of human pendulum. "Drunk in the daytime," I said quietly, more to myself than to Raymond. Raymond opened his mouth to reply when the old man finally toppled, fell backwards hard, and lay still. His shopping exploded around him, and I noticed he'd bought Tunnock's caramel logs and a jumbo pack of sausages. "Shit," said Raymond, stabbing at the button on the crossing control. "Leave him," I said. "He's drunk, he'll be fine." Raymond stared at me.
"He's a wee old man, Eleanor. He smacked his head on that pavement pretty hard," he said.
Then I felt bad. Even alcoholics deserve help, I suppose, although they should get drunk at home like I do so that they don't cause anyone else any trouble. But then not everyone is as sensible and considerate as me. Finally, the green man flashed and Raymond jogged across the road, having flung his cigarette into the gutter. No need to be a little out, I thought, walking at a more measured pace behind him. When I reached the other side, Raymond was already kneeling beside the old man, feeling for a pulse in his neck. He was talking loudly and slowly, silly nonsense like, "Hiya, old-timer, how you doing?" and "Can you hear me, mister?" The old man didn't respond. I leaned over him and sniffed deeply. "He's not actually drunk," I said. "You'd smell it if he were drunk enough to fall over and pass out." Raymond started loosening the man's clothing.
"Call an ambulance, Eleanor," he said quietly.
"I don't possess a mobile telephone," I explained, "although I'm open to persuasion with regard to their efficacy." Raymond rummaged in his duffel coat pocket and tossed me his.
"Hurry up," he said. "The old guy's out cold."
I started to dial 999, and then a memory punched me full in the face. I couldn't do it again, I realised. I simply couldn't live and listen to a voice saying, "Which service do you require, caller?" then approaching sirens. I touched my scars and then threw the phone back at Raymond.
"You do it," I said. "I'll sit with him."
Raymond swore under his breath and stood up.
"Keep talking and don't move him," he said.
I took off my jerkin and placed it over the man's torso.
"Hello," I said. "I'm Eleanor Oliphant."
"Keep talking to him," Raymond had said, so I did.
"What a lovely sweater," I said. "You don't see that colour often on a woollen garment. Would you describe it as vermilion? Or carmine, perhaps?
I rather like it. I wouldn't attempt such a shade myself, of course, but against the odds, I think you'd just about carry it off. White hair and red clothing, like Father Christmas."
"Was the sweater a gift?" "It looks like a gift, all soft and expensive. It's far too nice a thing to buy for yourself. But perhaps you do buy nice things for yourself. Some people do, I know. Some people think nothing of treating themselves to the best of everything. Mind you, looking at the rest of your clothes and the contents of your shopping bag, it seems highly unlikely that you're that sort of person."
I braced myself and took three deep breaths, then slowly put out my hand and placed it over his. I held it gently for as long as I could bear.
"Mr. Gibbons is calling an ambulance," I said. "So don't worry, you won't be lying here in the middle of the street for long. There's no need to be anxious. Medical care is completely free of charge in this country, and the standard is generally considered to be among the best in the world. You're a fortunate man. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to fall and bump your head in, say, the new state of South Sudan, given its current political and economic situation. But here in Glasgow, well, you've struck it lucky, if you'll pardon the pun." Raymond hung up and scuttled over.
"How's he doing, Eleanor?" he said. "Has he come round yet?"
"No," I said, "but I've been talking to him like you asked."
Raymond took the man's other hand.
"Good old soul," he said.
I nodded. Surprisingly, I felt an emotion that I recognised as anxiety or concern in relation to this elderly stranger. I sat back,
and my buttocks bumped against something large and curvaceous. When I turned around to check, it was a huge plastic bottle of Iron Brew. I stood up and stretched my spine out and then started to collect the spilled shopping and put it into the carrier bags. One of them was torn, so I went into my shopper and took out my favourite bag for life, the Tesco one with lions on it. I packed all the comestibles and placed the bags by the old man's feet. Raymond smiled at me. We heard the sirens and Raymond handed me my jerkin. The ambulance pulled up alongside us and two men got out. They were in the middle of a conversation, and I was surprised at how proletarian they sounded. I thought they'd be more like doctors.
All right, said the older one. What do we have here, then? The old boy's taken a tumble, has he?
Raymond filled him in, and I watched the other one. He was bent over the old man, taking his pulse, shining a little torch into his eyes and tapping him gently to try to elicit a response. He turned to his colleague.
We need to get moving, he said.
They fetched a stretcher and were fast and surprisingly gentle as they lifted the old man and strapped him on. The younger man wrapped a red fleece blanket around him. Same colour as his jumper, I said, but they both ignored me.
You coming with them? The older man asked. Only room for one in the back, mind.
Raymond and I looked at one another. I glanced at my watch. The visitor was due at Shea Oliphant in half an hour.
I'll go, Eleanor, he said. You don't want to miss your chiropody appointment.
I nodded, and Raymond climbed in beside the old man and the paramedic, who was busy connecting drips and monitors. I picked up the shopping bags and lifted them high enough to pass across to Raymond.
Look, said the paramedic, sounding slightly tetchy, this isn't the Asda van. We don't deliver shopping.
Raymond was on the phone, and I heard him talking, apparently to his mother, telling her that he'd be late before he quickly hung up.
Eleanor, he said,
why don't you give me a call in a bit and maybe you could bring his stuff over to him? I considered this, nodded, watched as he rummaged in his coat pocket and took out a biro. He grabbed my hand. I gasped and stepped to the side, shocked, placing my hand firmly behind my back. I need to give you my phone number, he said patiently. I took out my little notebook from the shopper, which he returned with a page covered in blue scribble, his name barely legible there, and a series of numbers scrawled below it in an awkward, childish hand.
Give it an hour or so, he said. Your bunions will be dealt with by then, won't they?
Chapter 6.
I had barely had time to get home and divest myself of my outer garments when the doorbell rang 10 minutes earlier than I'd been expecting, probably trying to catch me out. When I opened it, slowly, keeping the chain on, it wasn't the person I'd been expecting. Whoever it was, she wasn't smiling.
Eleanor Oliphant? June Mullen, social work, she said, stepping forward, her progress blocked by the door.
Well, I was expecting Heather, I said, peering around.
Heather's off sick, I'm afraid. We've no idea when she'll be back. I've taken over her cases.
I asked to see some form of official identification. I mean, you can't be too careful. She gave a tiny sigh and began to look in her bag. She was tall, carefully dressed in a black trouser suit and white shirt. As she bent her head, I noticed the white stripe of scalp at the parting, in her shiny dark bob. Eventually she looked up and thrust out a security pass with a huge council logo and a tiny photo. I scrutinised it carefully, looking from the photograph to her face and back again several times. It wasn't a flattering shot, but I didn't hold that against her. I'm not particularly photogenic myself. In real life she was about my age, with smooth, unlined skin and a slash of red lipstick.
You don't look like a social worker, I said.
She stared at me but said nothing. Not again. In every walk of life, I encounter people with underdeveloped social skills with alarming frequency. Why is it that client-facing jobs hold such a lure for misanthropes? It's a conundrum. I made a mental note to return to the topic later, unhooked the chain and invited her in. I showed her into the lounge, listening to her high heels clicking across the floor. She asked if she could have a quick tour. I'd been expecting that, of course. Heather used to do that too. I assume that it's part of the job, checking to make sure that I'm not storing my own urine in demijohns or kidnapping magpies and sewing them into pillowcases. She complimented me unenthusiastically on the interiors as we went into the kitchen. I tried to see my home through the eyes of a visitor. I'm aware that I am very fortunate to live here, social housing in this area being virtually non-existent these days. I couldn't possibly afford to live in this postcode otherwise, certainly not on the pittance that Bob pays me. Social services arranged for me to move here after I had to leave my last foster placement, the summer immediately before I started university. I just turned 17. Back then, a vulnerable young person who'd grown up in care would be allocated a council flat close to her place of study without it being too much of a problem. Imagine that. It took me a while to get around to decorating, I remember, and I finally painted the place in the summer after I graduated. I bought emulsion and brushes after cashing a check I received in the post from the university registry, along with my degree parchment. It turned out that I'd won a small prize, set up in the name of some long-dead classicist for the best finals performance in a paper on Virgil's Georgics. I graduated in absentia, of course. It seemed pointless to process onto the stage with no one there to applaud me. The flat hadn't been touched since then. I suppose, trying to be objective, that it was looking rather tired. Mummy always said that an obsession with home interiors was tediously bourgeois, and worse still, that any kind of do-it-yourself activities were very much the preserve of the hoi polloi. It's quite frightening to think about the ideas that I may have absorbed from Mummy. The furniture was provided by a charity that helps vulnerable young people and ex-offenders when they move into a new home, donated mismatched things for which I was most grateful at the time and continue to be. It was all perfectly functional, so I'd never seen the need to replace any of it. I didn't clean the place very often, I supposed, which might contribute to what I could see might be perceived as a general air of neglect. I didn't see the point. I was the only person who ever ate here, washed here, went to sleep, and woke up here. This June Mullen was the first visitor I'd had since November last year. They come around every 6 months or so, the social work visits. She's my first visitor this calendar year. The meter reader hasn't been yet, although I must say I prefer it when they leave a card and I can phone in my reading. I do love call centres. It's always so interesting to hear all the different accents and try to find out a bit about the person you're talking to. The best part is when they ask at the end, "Is there anything else I can help you with today, Eleanor?" And I can then reply, "No, no, thank you, you've completely and comprehensively resolved my problems." It's always nice to hear my first name spoken aloud by a human voice, too. Apart from social work and the utility companies, sometimes a representative from one church or other will call round to ask if I've welcomed Jesus into my life. They don't tend to enjoy debating the concept of proselytising, I found, which is disappointing. Last year, a man came to deliver a Betterware catalogue, which turned out to be a most enjoyable read. I still regret not purchasing the spider catcher, which really was a very ingenious device. June Mullen declined my offer of a cup of tea as we returned to the living room, and after sitting down on the sofa, she pulled my phone from her briefcase. It was several inches thick, held together precariously by a rubber band. Some unknown hand had written "Oliphant, Eleanor," in marker pen on the top right-hand corner, and dated it July 1987, the year of my birth. The buff folder, tattered and stained, looked like a historical artefact. "Heather's handwriting is atrocious," she muttered, running a manicured fingernail down the page at the top of the pile of papers. She spoke quietly, to herself rather than to me. biannual visits, continuity of community integration, early identification of any additional support needs. She continued to read, and then I saw her face change, and she glanced at me, her expression a mixture of horror, alarm, and pity. She must have got to the section about Mummy. I stared her out. She took a deep breath, looked down at the papers, and then exhaled slowly as she looked up at me again. "I had no idea," she said, her voice echoing her expression. "Do you... you must miss her terribly."
"Mummy," I said. "Hardly."
"No, I meant..."
She trailed off, looking awkward, sad, embarrassed. I knew them well. These were the holy trinity of Oliphant expressions. I shrugged, having no idea whatsoever what she was talking about.
Silence sat between us, shivering with misery. After what felt like days had passed, June Mullen closed the file on her lap and gave me an overly bright smile.
"So, Eleanor, how have you been getting on generally since Heather's last visit, I mean?"
"Well, I haven't become aware of any additional support needs, and I'm fully integrated into the community, June," I said.
She smiled weakly.
"Work going okay? I see you're a..."
She consulted the file again.
"You work in an office?"
"Work is fine," I said. "Everything's fine."
"What about home?" she said,
looking round the room, her eyes lingering on my big green poof, which is shaped like a giant frog and was part of the charity furniture donation I'd received when I first moved in. I'd grown very fond of his bulbous eyes and giant pink tongue over the years. One night, a vodka night, I'd drawn a big housefly, Musca domestica, on his tongue with a pilfered Sharpie. I'm not artistically gifted in any way, but it was, in my humble opinion, a fair rendering of the subject matter. I felt that this act had helped me to take ownership of the donated item and created something new from something second-hand. Also, he had looked hungry. June Mullen seemed unable to take her eyes off it.
"Everything's fine here, June," I reiterated. "Bills all paid, cordial relations with the neighbours. I'm perfectly comfortable."
She flicked through the file again and then inhaled. I knew what she was about to say, recognising full well the change in tone, fear, hesitancy, that always preceded the subject matter.
"You're still of the view that you don't want to know anything else about the incident, or about your mother, I understand?"
No smiling this time.
"That's right," I said. "There's no need. I speak to her once a week on a Wednesday evening, regular as clockwork."
"Really? After all this time, that's still happening? Interesting. Are you keen to maintain this contact?"
"Why wouldn't I be?"
I said, incredulous. Where on earth does the social work department find these people?
She deliberately allowed the silence to linger. And although I recognised the technique, I could not stop myself from filling it eventually.
"I think Mummy would like it if I tried to find out more about the incident, but I've no intention of doing so."
"No," she said, nodding. "Well, how much you want to know about what happened is entirely up to you, isn't it? The courts were very clear back then that anything like that was to be entirely at your discretion."
"That's correct," I said. "That's exactly what they said."
She looked closely at me, as so many people had done before, scrutinising my face for any traces of Mummy, enjoying some strange thrill at being this close to a blood relative of the woman the newspaper still occasionally referred to all these years later as the pretty face of evil. I watched her eyes run over my scars. Her mouth hung slightly open, and it became apparent that the suit and the bob were an inadequate disguise for this particular slack-jawed yokel.
"I could probably dig out a photograph if you'd like one," I said.
She blinked twice and blushed.
then busied herself by grappling with a bulging file, trying to sort out all the loose papers into a tidy pile. I noticed a single sheet flutter down and land under the coffee.